for December 2015. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and today I am joined for the first time in Cinema Faith history by another voice, the one and only Mr. Tim Nelson. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Yes, now this is pretty exciting for me. I've been going it alone for quite a while, so I finally get to have an actual conversation, which is super fun, and I really appreciate you coming on. Now, Tim, since most people listening don't know you, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what gets you excited about film and faith?
Okay. I'm a pastor, and I also love film, and so a lot of times John and I will see films and talk about them and do research on them, and so that's really interesting to me. I'm also into theology, and so it's cool to see where those two come together, because it's usually pretty exciting. I also love art, and I think art for art's sake. So if it's good, it's I appreciate it. So that's why I love to hear Cinema Faith. I like to read the blog and check out the website. So yeah, definitely. So I just come as a person that really loves film, loves theology, and loves art.
Awesome. Well, we are happy to have you. Now, as you know, we're in the thick of award season. I don't know how much you get into Oscars. Are Oscars your thing?
They're not really my thing. I'm going to be honest with you. I like good movies, but mm-hmm. I don't, you know, like to me, that's not the end all award.
Now, I'm an Oscar freak. So
I know you are.
You know that. So,
yeah,
okay.
I know you are.
Okay. So humor me. This is an exciting time of the year for me. We got all these movies that are just coming out of the woodwork left and right, and they're good movies because they're all trying to vie for an Oscar nomination. So it's exciting. So I just thought, since we're right in the middle of it, like that we should take a step back and look 1 year ago at what won Best Picture for 2014, which is, of course, Birdman.
Yep.
Birdman. So now let me say up front, I think Birdman is a perfect film.
It's a perfect film.
I know you agree because you texted me after you saw it and you said it was a perfect film.
It's a perfect film.
Yep,
I mean, we agree on that.
Yep.
I don't know if we're going to agree about everything about Birdman.
It's all right.
But we do agree it's a perfect film.
Thank you. All right. Now, we're going to get in depth to why Birdman is great, but I want to give a little plot synopsis just for those who are listening, maybe have not seen the film. So Birdman basically stars Michael Keaton. He is a fictitious actor named Regan Thompson. And Regan is this guy who was a superhero way back in the day, and the superhero was Birdman. And so that's his past. He did a couple Birdman movies, and then he refused to do a sequel. And now he's sort of this washed-up actor that really wants to prove himself and do something legitimate, do something super artistic. So he is forming a play by the great playwright Raymond Carver, and he's on Broadway, and so he's got all these other actors that are doing this play with him, and basically the movie's just about him struggling with his inner demons. It's a little surrealistic, like the Birdman voice from his past movies like talks to him. He can make objects move, which is a little weird, and we don't know whether what's really real, what's in his head. So he's kind of struggling with his past, struggling to maintain himself as an artist and put on this play.
So he's basically Michael Keaton.
Exactly. Well, we're going to get to that.
He's Michael Keaton.
Thank you. I want to talk about the technique first, because what struck you about the technique, first of all, Tim? What stood out?
I'm going to be honest, and some of our listeners here may have not picked up on this the first round, because I didn't pick up on it. I'm not a technical guy. I'm more a story guy.
Okay.
And I did not pick up on the one-shot technique.
Really?
I did
like
not
it just
pick
completely
up on
went
it.
Over your head.
It went over my head because I'm more interested in the story.
Okay.
For the most part, than I am into the one shot. So I watched the second time I watched it, because I watched this film over and over again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The second time I watched it, the one shot was like amazing, and it was almost distracting to me.
Well, you know what? And that's interesting, because a friend of mine said the same thing, that he actually spent the whole movie trying to figure out where they cut away, and so it was actually distracting him from the plot.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But yeah, the whole movie basically is the illusion of one continuous shot, and you can tell if you look hard that there are moments where it's obvious that they're cutting into something else. But if you play with your mind, basically the camera just roams around through these hallways, and it's one continuous shot. So I think just from a technical perspective, it's pretty amazing that way. The cinematographer won an Oscar for his work in Birdman. Emmanuel Lubezki is his name. He won an Oscar for it.
If they'd done nothing else, like if this film didn't have any other value,
right,
They did a one-shot film, totally. Which is just amazing to me.
Yeah, why is that technically not a one-shot film? I mean, there are horror movies who are technically one-shot, which is pretty amazing.
I know that there are parts where they used computers, and I know there are shots that you can see that. And like, obviously, you can't have an overnight shot be a one-shot. I know there's different parts in the film where that happens. But for the most part...
Yes, a lot of very continuous shots that last a long time, and that's rare. Yeah.
It's impressive. That alone is impressive about the film from a technical standpoint.
Totally agree.
And I felt I hope there's someone else out there it's not just me that's just didn't see this.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh my gosh.
It could be just you. It's pretty obvious. But, you know, hey, it's all good. It's all good. The music. I want to talk about the music because it's a pretty cool score. Like it has sort of this pitter patter drum thing going on, like always, but it also kind of morphs into something more bigger and then quieter and more mournful and melodic. So, I what do you think about the score?
So this is like an area of isn't this an area of much contention because it wasn't there? They were denied into the category for the score.
I did not hear about this.
Yeah, I think it was either that or soundtrack or something because so much of it is. There is the drums, right?
Yeah.
And you actually have the drummer is visible.
Yeah. At least one some point. Actor that's right. Yeah.
And in the film. But I think like, as far as the score goes, most of that is classical music. That's like public domain or it wasn't composed, which is bizarre because, the director actually has some background in composing. And so to me, I guess he's kind of paying homage to some of those pieces. I haven't looked in depth about what exactly who those folks are.
Yeah.
But I know that it was disqualified from that category because it wasn't considered a true sound, a true score or a true soundtrack because it's not all original.
That's bizarre because it sounds so intentional throughout. Like, I mean, it just with the themes and everything, it goes so perfectly with the movie.
Yeah, I need to know. I honestly don't remember what the category is,
but
it was disqualified from one of these categories.
What a shame.
Yeah, it was too bad.
And also, like, there's this really good blend of the theater and film that I noticed throughout. You know, like, you obviously the movie's about a play, so it's very theatrical more than most films, but it also feels like a dynamic movie as well. I like that interplay between film and theater.
Yeah, there are some films that, you know, I think of particularly. This is obscure. Most listeners probably don't know this one, but, like, there's one called The Big Kahuna.
Never heard of that one.
Yeah, it's older. It's from the 90s. It's Danny DeVito, Kevin Spacey, and I can't remember the other actor.
Nice.
But that's like, that was taken from a play and turned into a film, and it doesn't have the dynamism of a film. It's a play that happens to be filmed, right?
When you think of Glengarry Glen Ross, which is kind of along those lines, but you can usually tell when a play has been turned into a movie because it has that, I don't know what it is exactly, gives it that theater quality to it, but this has it for sure.
And it's almost like the movie's arguing I don't know if it's arguing that film, but it has an anti-blockbuster feel to it. I don't know
definitely.
If you agree with that.
But that's kind of one of the battles in the movie is like he's struggling with this with art versus the blockbuster, and so that's actually they deal with that pretty head on later on in the film. And of course, the movie was directed by Alejandro Iñárritu. I hope I'm saying that right.
Well, you did better than I'm not going to try.
Yeah, exactly.
We could admire from afar.
Totally. Now he's of course coming up with The Revenant, which is coming out soon with Leonardo DiCaprio, which looks awesome. We should check that out together next
month. We should check it out. Yeah. Maybe talk about it. I don't know.
That would be great. So, and let's talk about the acting. Michael Keaton. Goodness sakes, Michael Keaton's great in this. I mean, seriously. He is. What are you looking at me for?
I'm just afraid. You know, I don't want to say anybody shines too bright after watching this movie, right?
Oh, right. That's true.
No, but he was excellent. Yeah,
he was.
I think he's good. I think that he's good before this, but you do think it.
Well, that's the question. Okay, so you have 1989, Tim Burton Batman, right? You have the sequel to that. Then what? Like .. Birdman. I cannot think.
So I heard people say Mr. Mom.
Okay.
Isn't that Keaton?
Okay.
That's Keaton,
that's
isn't
Keaton.
It?
So now that Multiplicity, I'm seeing the cover where it's like 10 Michael Keatons on the cover now that you mention it.
Yeah, I don't know if that's where I would. So here's where I would go.
Yeah.
Okay, I think the fact that he worked with Burton means something.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he worked with Burton prior on Beetlejuice.
Okay, yes.
And so
Beetlejuice.
Like Beetlejuice is a very artsy film.
Mm-hmm.
It requires, I mean, he basically has to lead the way on that. Yeah, you get Winona Ryder, but I think that like working with a creative force like Tim Burton, I think Burton's like, hey, I work with this guy in Beetlejuice. This guy would make a great Batman.
Mm.
And
so Beetlejuice came before Batman.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, okay.
Absolutely. I think it was 1988. They're very close.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would say like Burton worked with him prior, and said, hey, this guy's going to make a good Batman. People are like, really?
But he was a good Batman.
A good Birdman, yeah.
And so, I lost my train of thought. Yeah, Batman. Okay, yes, Batman. And then, so you brought up, so Beetlejuice came before. I remember Pacific Heights. Have you ever seen that
movie? No, I haven't seen that. What's that about?
He plays this creepy tenant upstairs where, like, there's this nice married couple downstairs, and he's this, like, psychopath upstairs, and he just, like, is annoying this couple, and they want him to leave, and he won't leave, and he's, like, drilling holes in the ceiling and stuff. I think I remember that because I shouldn't have been watching it. I was slightly too young, so
yeah,
that stands out.
That's what you like. You like that genre, man. That's your thing. You're like,
it's true.
But that shows you he has a little range.
Yeah, he has a range. But there was a huge gap. I mean, like, just even if you think of the last 5 years prior to Birdman, I cannot think of a single thing that he was in.
So he's defined by Batman.
Yeah, right.
Just like the character is defined by Birdman.
Thank you. Yes, yeah. He is. And the interesting thing is, so that's a big thing in the movie, is that he's struggling with kind of letting go of his past accomplishments as Birdman. And you can't help but notice the similarities between Michael Keaton being basically known for Batman, and now here he is in this Oscar, you know, award-winning film trying to do the same thing that his fictitious character is. But the thing is that everyone involved in Birdman denies that that there's any intentionality to that whatsoever. It's all a big coincidence.
Do they want to get sued?
I mean, I
don't know. He talks in his Batman voice, like in the, like when he goes,
yeah,
you know, that's
is
the
it?
Yeah, Batman.
I've got to watch Tim Burton's Batman again.
You do?
Oh my gosh!
And there's even references to Clooney, because Clooney's the next Batman in Birdman.
Yeah.
He's like, Clooney, you know, oh, Clooney got it, Batman 4, whatever it was. It was the next cycle of Batman. It was
and
Clooney.
And they talk about the other superheroes. Like, they need a replacement for the play, and they want to get Jeremy Renner. He's doing an Avengers movie.
Yeah.
And they want to get – then he sees Robert Downey Jr. on the TV and talking about Iron Man, and it's just like that battle. Yeah, totally. So, yeah, I think that's honestly a load that they deny that. But, hey, it's all good. Now, Michael Keaton did not win Best Actor for Birdman. That went to Eddie Redmayne for Theory of Everything, who played Stephen Hawking. Now, this leads to a debate, because I actually got into a little bit of an argument with a fellow film buff around that time, who was arguing that Michael Keaton was the best performance of this year, and that I was brainwashed by the Oscars by thinking that you have to physically transform yourself and arch your back and have this whole new dialect like Eddie Redmayne in order to actually have a good performance. So the question is, what makes up good acting? In my mind, Michael Keaton is doing a fantastic Michael Keaton impression, like you said before. Eddie Redmayne is the better performance, but... Is that really true?
I'm not a great judge of it, to be honest. I like film. I love, like I said, I focus on the story. I'm not a great judge of great acting.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest.
That's okay.
But I would say, like, what did Norton win for any of that?
Norton was nominated. I do not think he won. I should know this, but I'm pretty sure he did not win.
So I thought Norton was amazing.
Yeah.
Obviously, every time I see a Norton film, it's amazing.
Yeah,
but I really did. Like, I thought
Ed
Norton was... exceptional in this, and we saw some of his range.
But what is it about Edward Norton? This drives me crazy, because he doesn't ever do anything that's like super, you know, he doesn't really become a character, you know, but he's always fascinating and always engaging. Like, there's something about Edward Norton. He's just got that it factor.
It feels like he slips in and out of different personas,
mm-hmm.
and he isn't really, he's very at ease in that. In fact, mm-hmm. and that's what he does in this film, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, we can get more into the themes, but he is trying out different personas with different people that are within that cast.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's so true.
Which fits right into like the idea of a movie. But yeah,
right. Did you ever watch Primal Fear, his debut?
No.
Oh, it's really, really good. And when I think, as I was saying that he doesn't really become a character, that showed a lot of range early on, because he plays this kind of split personality disorder guy who's like this nice southern boy, and then he transforms into this really domineering, like, psychopath, like, off and on. And
so it's
Richard
like Fight
Gere.
It's like Fight Club.
Yeah, that's true.
He does that doesn't he? He can go from like
that
this,
dual personality. Yeah,
like. Yeah, he can go from the, you know, shop for furniture at IKEA in my khakis to, like, I'm going to beat your face in.
That's so true. There is a lot of similarities between Primal Fear and Fight Club.
American History X, he's like mommy's boy at the dinner table, and then he's like a crazed Nazi.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean...
We're on to something. That's it.
Yeah.
That's Edward Norton.
He can play the polarity there, yeah.
Right. Other actors in the movie, Emma Stone, who I thought was pretty awesome in it. Like, I best performance I've seen of her anyway. Emma Stone, she had a lot of really good moments where she could just let it go and have some had a really good monologue with Michael Keaton. So yeah, it's great acting all around. So I want to talk about some of the themes here. One of them is movie criticism. So there's this critic in the movie. Her name's Tabitha Dickinson. She writes for the New York Times. And she is – everyone is aware that basically they're performing this entire play for her because she will single-handedly decide whether this movie continues to run on Broadway or whether it gets basically canceled in a week. Her 500-word review will determine that. And I think that brings up a really – interesting theme because, you know, here we are, we're talking about Birdman, we're film critics, if you want to say that, and this whole idea of criticism is really is perturbing to artists. There's a battle, it seems, between the artists and the critics. There's a something on Michael Keaton's window that says a thing is a thing, not what's said of that thing. Mm-hmm. Right? And so that goes back to this idea that I mean, think about, like, the tomato meter today, right? I mean, there's a lot of power to it. Think about you spent, like, 2 years making a movie, and you come out with it, and you're excited, and then it gets, like, a 9%. I mean, you're done, right? So is that fair?
Or it's so bad, you get recognized, you know?
Right. But I don't know.
So you're asking, is it, you know, I think that it's an interesting relationship with a critic mm-hmm. within mm-hmm. the film, because I think the idea of risk... is a critic does not risk anything.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, and I think the Norton character says it right when he says, you know, this thing may be awful. This isn't verbatim.
Yeah.
It's like, but when he confronts the critic, this might be awful, but he's getting out there, you know, he's actually right. going to go risk something. He's going to put himself on the line for this, even if he's a terrible actor, and you'll never do that.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's the idea of what she said. I can't remember
that's
exactly
the thing.
What
well,
she said.
Well, and then he quotes that French author, Flaubert, who says, a man becomes a critic when he can't be an artist, in the same way a man becomes an informer when he can't be a soldier. You know, it's just kind of that idea that she's sitting back and just putting labels on everything, but she's not risking herself. She's not out there. And yet, she holds all the power. Like, she's the one who's going to close down their play if she doesn't like it.
But she also... See, I think that's not... I think it's a tough thing, because also the same critic can also... make your play run forever and ever and right. can make it successful. So to me, it's like they need that critic.
Yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword.
Right.
So it's like they hate her when she hates them, but they love her when she loves them.
That's true.
And
that's
so, true. You know, to me, I think that the critic is, they have fear of the critic, and the critic does have power. Mm-hmm. But I think they want that approval of that
mm-hmm,
critic.
Mm-hmm. I argued the same thing. I did an article about that. Do film critics matter? And I argued it's a relationship that's necessary. The film critics, and Alyssa Wilkinson in Christianity Today has a great article about this too, about how film critics are basically a part of the process, and they're necessary. They're not just byproducts. They're actually like they react and they enhance. Mm-hmm. The filmmakers and the themes and stuff. So that's interesting. But yeah, I don't know.
I also think you have to be pretty good these days with the kind of now when we have such an egalitarian environment online mm-hmm. Compared to how it was in the old days.
Sure.
I think that to be a really well-known critic at this point, you have to be a good critic. You have to be consistent. People have to trust you. So I don't think being a critic, you're not risking anything. I think that there is some level of where you do kind of survival of the best critics.
Well, and you think about the tomato meter. I brought that up. You have to have a website that has 500,000 unique visitors every month.
I didn't know that.
So you have a huge audience. It's not just mm-hmm. like random Joe Blow can just pop be a part of the tomato meter. So yeah, you're right. There's an exclusivity there that if you have that big of a following, you're probably worth your salt. So mm-hmm. yeah.
So I think yeah, or you know, but then that gets into like, you know, who's got Birdman had a big following, right?
right.
I mean, does that make it good? So uh-huh. that I mean, this gets into the part of the is there some intrinsic goodness to something?
Mm-hmm.
Which gets into some of the themes that we're going to talk about later, but. You know, I do think that is a real theme. Is there something intrinsically good about this, or do we just kind of base it on a few people's opinions or what they are willing to accept or not or reject? So yeah. I don't know. I think it's interesting. I think it's needed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Agreed. let's get into that a little bit right away. Let's dive into the themes, because one of the main reasons I was excited to sit down with you is I think we see the movie a little differently thematically.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I'm gonna give you my take. Okay. I'm just gonna lay it all out there, and then I'm gonna let you bash it to pieces. All right? It's all good. It's all good,
man.
Don't worry. So, okay, so...
You're laying it out there, man. You've got, you know, you're the one that's risking here. I'm not. I'm the critic now.
Uh-huh, that's right.
Oh, this is terrible.
This is it. All right, here we go. So what I think of Birdman, basically, my big takeaway is... Okay, so it starts off with this quote at the beginning. You remember the quote at the beginning where it says, by Raymond Carver, which is fitting, it says, "And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so, I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth." And the movie's called Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, so to me, the movie is really about creating something as an artist, and that struggle to create amidst the voices that are always swirling around your head, that are swirling out there, and how hard it is to create something that's pure and to be true to yourself. So, I mean, if you think about it, whenever you sit down to do anything in any genre, whether it's write a song, every time I sit down to write a review, you always start off with the blank page, right? So you're staring there at like a Word document, the cursor's blinking, and you're like, then that's when the voices start. It's like, I'm a fraud. This isn't going to work. I don't have all these these defeating voices. And also there's other people out there who, you know, in your mind are doing it better than you, say it better than you. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Michael Keaton's struggling with. That's what Riggan is struggling with in the movie. The Birdman voice represents all of those voices. They're just, he's constantly chiming in. And in a way, the Birdman voice is pulling him towards compromise, because there is an easier way to get what you want than to be a part of the painstaking journey of creating something original and meaty. Like there are compromises you can make that actually get you to the same goal of fame or popularity. And that Birdman voice is constantly pulling him back. It's always like, hey, come on, man. Just make Birdman 3. Everyone will love you. You'll be a box office sensation. You'll get all kinds of money. You know, why are you in this dirty, smelly theater, you know, doing this play? And
he asks himself that question.
He does.
Right?
Yeah. He does.
Why are we here? In his Batman voice.
Right. And I think that's the temptation, is that the temptation is to compromise. And only when we are able to put aside those voices and be true to ourselves can we really create something that's special. And, you know, I think, like, also as a Christian, it shouldn't be this way, but if you think about it, we're part of the body of Christ, right? We all have different roles to play. We all have a different calling, different talents. Mm-hmm. And yet we spend so much time competing against each other, just like the world, you know? And it's sad. So, I mean, I'll give you a real-world example, being vulnerable here. I stumbled across another website recently that was very similar to ours. And instead of just being able to congratulate that website, you know, they've been at it a lot longer and whatever, I'm always thinking, wow, what are they doing differently than mine? Are they better than me? You know, how can I get to that level? And that's so sad.
Right.
And so that's what I think all these voices is what's going on in Riggan's head. And so you have towards the end of the movie, won't give away any spoilers here, but there's kind of, to me, two death and resurrection moments. So you have one where I think Michael Keaton kind of gives in to Birdman, and he kind of gives up basically this dream of the play and becomes Birdman again and says, yes, I'm giving in. And, you know, you have that awesome shot of him flying mm-hmm. over the city.
Yeah.
And but then he snaps out of it and he goes back to the play. And that's when you have, I think, the second death and resurrection moment, where he just says, for the first time, he's willing to get rid of the baggage of Birdman. And he metaphorically and kills Birdman. I think he kills these voices inside of him, and when he comes out of that, then you see a different Riggan. You see this true honesty, and you even see it as in his last monologue.
We kind of need to spoil it, man, to like
really get into this.
It's been a year and a half, man. I think we can spoil this
a little bit. All right,
I think we need to get into it. We can get into it a little bit. But
okay.
Go ahead.
If you have not seen Birdman, please skip ahead just a few minutes. We'll keep it brief, but yes, let's go ahead and kind of lay out what happens here. Okay, so in the end, basically, throughout the movie, we see him doing the same monologue over and over again, which is the last scene of the play, and it ends with him shooting himself in the head. So in the last scene, the last time we see him do this, he actually takes a real gun and he shoots himself in the head. Now the question is then, was he really trying to kill himself? And I would argue that he wasn't. I think if he was really trying to kill himself, you know, it could be in the mouth or right against his temple, but he does it in such a weird way. That's why I think that it's more of a moment of metaphor where he's really trying to kill. No, I know. I see it in your face.
You can't see it in a podcast, can you? All right, keep going. I'm listening. I'm letting you finish.
Okay.
I'm being a gentleman.
So that's what I see is this metaphor. And then he wakes up and he when he gives that final monologue, we've seen him give it many times. It's the most real and the most honest we've seen of him. It's his best performance that we've seen of him on the stage. And then so later on, then he can finally become the real artist that he was. And in the last scene, Birdman is in the hospital and he basically says goodbye to him. He flies out the window and he is now not Birdman. He's Regan Thompson with a new nose and everything, able to actually be the artist that he always wanted to be. That's my take. I see it as optimistic. I see it as a celebration of the artist. Tim, it's your move.
It's like we're playing chess here or something. So I see it a little bit differently. I think the quote for the beloved quote, I think that's like, I don't know if you have that here. But I had pulled it up earlier.
Yes.
I don't have it in front of me.
And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so, I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel myself beloved on the earth. From Raymond Carver. Yeah.
So I think that is paired. The very next scene after that. So you have this idea of what is the point of existence, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's one of Carver's last poems. And it is a fragment, meaning it's only part of the story, right? And so that's one of his last poems. That is a poem in entirety, but it's called The Fragment. There should be something. It implies there's other parts of it.
Huh. Okay.
The next, it's a scene that I missed the first three times I watched it. There's a comet or an asteroid that's come in the atmosphere and it's burning up.
Yeah.
And
jellyfish on the beach, right?
I don't remember the jellyfish.
There is, which goes back to something he tells his ex-wife.
Yeah, I remember that. I didn't realize there was jellyfish.
There is.
But I know the idea of that the whole metaphor of the comet, to me, usually the artist tells you what they're going to do. Because I'm in the story. I'm a story guy, and I'm into the symbolism. They usually tell you exactly what they're going to do in the beginning, and you don't get it yet. And so to me, the idea of this asteroid that's coming in, it's burning up, and it's beautiful. Mm. And the idea is its destruction is a thing that is drawing us to it. And so we're watching as this thing is entering in the atmosphere and we admire it. We think it's beautiful. And we're look at it. And the more it burns up, the more it falls apart and dies, the more it shines and blow and pops. So I think that's kind of the metaphor for it, which is I see Keaton as being similar to that, where he wants to be loved so much.
Yeah.
He wants to be famous, and not by the people that he should want to be loved by.
Right.
They're the people that can get a slice, that care more about getting a slice of cake afterwards than they do, and some coffee.
Right.
Than they do.
His daughter says that.
Than they actually care about him. But he wants to be beloved on the earth. And I think that's really huge. And so he's willing to do anything it takes. To do that. And so to me, that's a lot of the theme is, and it's not just him, it's other people. Norton's the same way. In fact, they're very similar characters. And they kind of, they get into this escalation of who will do the most outlandish thing to get the love, to be the beloved.
Yeah. And coming in that fight that they have, which is so awesome in the middle of the movie, they're literally rolling on the ground.
Yeah.
No,
so I see it starts out, Norton is at the review, right? And he totally flips out when he replaces his scotch with water. And he breaks character and he throws the glass and he just starts insulting him.
He says he's going to use the chicken because that's the only real thing he's got. Yeah, right? And then he says, that's a nice bird, man.
I forgot about the part that's hilarious. Yeah. So he does that, and then you have an escalated kind of this escalation of stuff where, and then Keaton goes out, and he didn't mean to do this, but he shows up and he does the last scene in his underwear in one of the reviews, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a beautiful scene because it actually was in Times Square, right?
Yes, and they used the band to distract people.
Yes. Yeah, that was really cool. You told me that, and I was just like, wow, how'd you find that out? But the idea is, so he escalates it, and then Norton escalates it one more where he basically acts, kiddies, don't listen. He actually has an erection, like in front of the entire audience.
Right.
And so to best him, his next step to best him to become more beloved than Norton, because that's what he fears, is to shoot himself in the head and kill himself, because that's the ultimate way to be beloved.
Wow.
So that's like my take on the story.
Well, that's really interesting, because when you think about it, that the duel between them is huge throughout the whole movie. Yeah.
But they're very similar.
Yeah.
But I haven't, as far as dealing with the Birdman character, he is the Birdman. I think he's the Birdman throughout the whole movie. I think he's got insecurities. I think he's got this idea of a built up self. So when he's destroying his makeup room,
right?
We know he's just destroying his makeup room. He's not like doing it with some kind of metaphysical telepathy. Oh, I don't even know the term, but he's not moving things with his mind.
Yeah.
Telekinesis. I don't think that's what it is. But no, he actually is destroying it. But it makes him feel like a god to destroy it. Mm. He says, "I'm a god." In actually one of those scenes that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And then his Birdmanness goes along with his alcoholism.
Yeah.
So for me,
because when he becomes Birdman, that's right after he basically gets drunk and passes out.
Yeah. And so to me, like, he yields to the Birdman. I think he is the Birdman to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
And what he wants to do is he wants to kill the Birdman because the Birdman, he wants to kill the Birdman. And part of killing the Birdman would be to kill himself, because then he won't be remembered as the Birdman. He'll be remembered as the actor who killed himself on stage. So, like, to me, that's, like, those are the – see, yeah, I'm into the story elements.
No, that's interesting. What you had mentioned, Ecclesiastes, when we had talked before, where do you see that playing into it?
So, what I really picked up on in some of it was the when he does become the Birdman, and when he goes to buy a bottle of scotch, I think, or whiskey or something, he comes out, and there's a guy that's reciting lines from Macbeth.
Yes.
And – which is interesting, because it kind of provides a line between us, actually all the way Shakespeare to Faulkner, all the way to Carver, right?
Hmm.
But the idea of he talks about it's the one where you get the title for Faulkner's novel, The Sound and the Fury.
Okay,
and I don't remember the lines. It's talking about life and kind of the futility of life, and it's a tale told by a madman, or no, told by an idiot.
Mm.
We probably should look that up. I had it earlier, but it's from Macbeth, and it's talking about the futility and the idea of sound and fury. I mean, that's the comet. I mean, the asteroid right there. Is that we do all these things, and it's like meaningless. So so we want to be beloved, so we have all this sound, all this fury, and even the character Macbeth, right? He has to do all these horrible things to become the king because somebody gave him the idea that he could become king. And he does. But he does all these horrible things to do it.
Yeah.
So that connects us. Then it connects us to the idea of the sound and the fury with Faulkner. But I don't want to get too much into that.
Right.
And then even the idea of what does it mean to be beloved, I think, is like throughout the whole thing. Like, what do we talk about when we talk about love?
Right. Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so what does it mean to be beloved? And that so that gets into a lot of our kind of Christian ideas to me. One as far as the Ecclesiastes theme, I think this idea of like we do all these things that we're seeking for meaning, we're seeking to be loved.
Yeah.
We want to be special. Like this idea of I'm above them all. So at his Birdman stage, which to me he's just an addict. Basically, he flies above the city, but he's really not doing. He's in a cab, and he's flying above the city, and he's like, I'm above them all. And that's like this machination, right? He's not really actually above anybody.
And that lady shouts out, "Are you doing a film?" And he's like, "Yeah." And then she's like, yells at him, like, "Oh, you darn filmmakers!" You know, it's like, "Yeah, that's interesting." So you see it as more of a kind of a mournful lament of where we are as humans, sort of outdoing each other and trying to be beloved, and it's all meaningless. Like,
I think the people that. I don't know if it's all meaningless. There is some meaning. I think this idea that we're chasing something that's 120% of who we are, I think is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea that we're trying to be a little, that we want to be above others, or that we want to be this immortalized self, I think, or a heroic self, which is funny because that's a Birdman, right? He's a hero.
Yeah. When our meaning is, of course, that we're children of God and we can rest in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Henry Nouwen is an author, and, you know, I don't know if any of your listeners have read him. Probably a lot of them. Some of them have. Some have. Mm-hmm. But he talks about most of our error in our lives comes from forgetting the fact that we're beloved by God.
Yeah.
And so that we tend to, usually when we wreck a lot of our lives, it's because we're acting out of a compulsive response to feeling unloved.
Yeah.
And so you see the Keaton character do that. You have the daughter who's actually pretty lucid. Is an Emma Stone character. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She's pretty lucid. She understands her place in the universe. She writes on the toilet paper, right?
Right,
so
right.
She's like, Dad, you just wiped your nose with all of human history or whatever.
That's great, yeah.
But she's lucid. She's actually pretty... Remember, she plays truth or dare all the time. She wants everybody to take dare, but they always take truth. Hmm. And so she's got this... She is kind of a truth character.
She is.
And so when you look at Emma Stone, she's like, I just came out of a recovery program. And so to me, like, I like her character because the idea there is like she has to try to be rooted in reality. Mm-hmm. And she seems like maybe the only character that is.
Because our strength is rooted in God's love. You're right. That's when we're strong. That's when we don't have to strive anymore because we're accepted. We don't need other people's approval. We don't need to feast on that because we have all the approval we could ever need in God.
Yeah. So I think that's... You have that theme. I think that I think they would say, no, this is part of the human. I think that the writers and the director, and I think a lot of writers, probably including Carver, would say this is part of our humanity. Mm-hmm. So not saying that we are not going to be beloved or feel beloved. We are beloved by God.
Right.
But the idea that we feel like we're not good enough, or that we're not who we should have been, or we're not the Ed Norton character, we're only the Birdman. I think that plagues a lot of people, comparing ourselves to others. And so I think that there is something that's part of humanity, because I don't know any Christians that are just like, I feel perfectly beloved all the time, right?
That's true. Yeah. That's
and if they did, I'd like want to steer clear. I'm like, okay.
But, you know, there is a sense where we should, and preaching the gospel to yourself every day, you know, that people talk about that. I think that's important, because we forget pretty much every single day. It's like waking up and reminding ourselves that, hey, we are beloved and we don't have to strive today. We don't, you know, we don't have to climb over each other because we have it. Yeah. Great reflections, man. Hey, I think both are valid, right? They're all kind of in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
Absolutely.
So the film's Birdman, and it's a perfect film, as we've said. If you have not seen it, please see it as soon as possible. You won't regret it. Tim, I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime, man. Anytime.
And you think you want to come back? You want to do this for real, regular?
Yeah, if people will put up with me. Yeah, sure.
Awesome. Now, before we sign off, hey, two things. Topical things. First of all, there's this really small indie movie coming out tomorrow. I don't know if you've heard of it, called The Force Awakens.
Can you remind me again about that?
Yeah, it's Star Wars. Have you... No,
is that
seriously.
Like Star Trek?
Very similar.
Okay.
Right. What are your thoughts on Star Wars? How pumped are you?
I'm scared, man. I am scared because I was so betrayed.
Yes.
For a number of years. Mm-hmm.
We all can identify with this.
Yeah, and you know. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Phantom Menace. It hurts. It's still to this day.
I can't look at a pod racer. I can't think about Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah.
Oh, and I said the name.
Now, did you... This is a question I ask everyone because I'm genuinely curious. Did you know during The Phantom Menace that it was a horrible movie? Like, as you're watching it, did your excitement just, this is bad? Or were you in denial? Because many were in denial for a few viewings.
It's consistently, like, just... a one-star film, man. Let me be honest. I tend to work on a star system.
Yeah.
It's a one-star film. Absolutely. I don't know if you can give a zero star.
It's an F in my book.
Yeah. It's just a terrible movie, and it's just going to get worse because it was so dependent on the CGI of that time.
Right.
That it only can get worse.
But if anyone can bring this franchise back from the dead, it's J.J. Abrams, right? Did you like the reboot that he did of Star Trek?
So I'm going to admit something. I haven't. I'm like the one guy in America that hasn't seen it.
Now, I'm not Trekkie. I'm not a huge fan of Star Trek, but what he did with that first film reboot was incredible. It's that too, you could argue, is a perfect film.
He's a known quantity, but have you seen what George Lucas and Steven Spielberg did to Indiana Jones?
Well, of course. But did you see what George Lucas did to the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I guess I would say he's a known quantity. It looks I've seen a few previews. I'm actually gonna go see it tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night, man.
I know.
My tickets are Sunday night.
I know. I don't know how it worked out. It's not even supposed to be released. I don't know how that works.
Great. Don't spoil anything.
I won't say anything. One thing I want to say about it that was really encouraging to me, just from a personal standpoint, is you actually have a black lead character.
Yes.
And so for me, like, that was really encouraging. Not an African American, but a black lead character.
Yes.
And like, to me, that's very encouraging because the franchise has not done a great job.
Absolutely.
You do have Billy Dee and you have Samuel L, but you haven't. But I think that they're supporting characters, and it seems like this is a lead character.
Yes.
That to me is very exciting to have that. Within the franchise.
Totally. Awesome. And then second topical question, Christmas is next week. Can you believe that? It blows my mind.
It is coming up, man.
Top three Christmas movies. Sorry to put you on the spot. Do you have three of them?
All right. I'm ready. Okay. I'd say my number one. I know I should probably go backwards, but that's not how my brain works.
Okay.
My number one is Home Alone. I'm a huge
Home Alone.
I am. I'm a huge John Hughes fan. I love that movie. I think it's a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody can watch it. I'm entertained still by it. My kids can watch it. It's just a great family movie. I'd say the next one's, as I'm getting older and I have some kids, I'd say National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation is totally. A very good movie. Yeah,
that's in mine three for sure.
And then my, I want to give you some cool answer, but the reality is I really like A Christmas Story.
Okay.
I think it's Shepard wrote it, and he's dead, but his writing is really good, and he did a lot of radio work before movies, so it has exceptional writing.
Sure.
And everyone's seen it 100 times and BB gun, haha, great. But I think the writing is really excellent. And
so
it reads like
a story. Home Alone and what was your third one?
National Lampoon's.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Awesome. Those are good picks. Totally. I would say, totally agree with you about Christmas Vacation. I would throw in there It's a Wonderful Life, which is not only a good Christmas movie, but one of the best movies ever made, I would argue.
Okay, all right.
And then my third, Muppet's Christmas Carol, I'm going to say is number three. I know. But hey,
John, I know we can disagree with Birdman, but this is some serious stuff, man.
Come on. Like,
Muppets?
Muppets Christmas Carol.
Muppets?
Michael Caine is out of this world in that movie. He is. And little tiny Tim.
I've seen it.
Giving the song about, I mean, if that doesn't bring tears to your eyes.
Guys,
come on.
Hey, I want you to just give John a pass on this one.
All right.
There's Muppets involved.
How about Die Hard?
Die Hard as a
Thank
Christmas?
You.
It's a Christmas movie.
It's a
movie.
Christmas movie. Yes.
Yeah.
Fine. I'll slide in Die Hard. But number four, Muppet's Christmas Carol.
All right. Fair enough. That is a very strange answer, man.
I'm sorry.
But I appreciate it because, I was not expecting that.
Well, listen, the thing about Muppet's Christmas Carol is there's some very explicit Christian themes, but it never feels heavy-handed. I really appreciate
that. Well, Dickens.
Well, okay. Yes. Thank you. But I don't know. All right. That's it. That's all we got. That's our show. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoy Star Wars when you finally get around to seeing it.
Yeah.
And Merry Christmas. Have a great Christmas with your friends, your family. And let's remember why we celebrate this thing, right? Tim, the all-powerful God of the universe became a baby.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Incarnation, man. Pretty,
yes.
Pretty wild, pretty grace-filled.
Absolutely.
Pretty mysterious.
It is. So, all right then, keep the faith, my friends, and we will see you next time.